Blog Talk Radio.
This never happened to the other fella.
We ain't one at a time in here. We're mass communicating.
Daggone right we are. James Bostic here with a conservative's perspective on the Patriot Nation Radio here at Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio, putting the blah, blah in Blog Talk. We do it two times a week. We do it Tuesdays, Thursdays, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And we have a recorded version of the show that goes out on Sundays at 4 p.m. Eastern, news and commentary that we do for Mojo 50 Radio. Mojo50.com. Outstanding programming, outstanding hosts. And they have a great feature at the website, Mojo50.com. You can go there and they have on the show window, when you go to the show tab, it lists all the shows in their broadcast order. You can listen to them as they go to air in their rotation, or if there's one you want to hit, you can go back through there and you can scroll through and you can listen to it in its archived format as well. Mojo 50 Radio, live free. We're, well, as advertised, and we haven't heard a whole lot about it, but we are, we're going to be listening to a lot of tonight. There is a white genocide raging in South Africa. And our guest tonight as a contributor is Mark Williamson. He's going to join us to talk about this. Mark is, without a doubt, what I would call a reliable and credible fellow. Just to give you a brief overview of this guy, 1987 graduate, University of Wisconsin. He attended there on a four-year United States Air Force ROTC scholarship, majored in Russian. Needless to say, the guy was a serious overachiever. He spent 7 years in the United States Air Force as an intelligence applications officer. He's certified to teach high school math in Texas and South Carolina. He is fluent in Russian, German, French, some Mandarin Chinese, which is really putting it over the top for me, and I'm going to let him go right there. But Mark is going to be with us. I met him through my work as an administrator on the Cowboy Logic Restoring America forum page at Facebook. Great friends, Don New and Donna Fiducia. And a couple of weeks back, I got an inbox from Mark asking me if I was aware of some of the things that were going on in terms of the heinous acts and really white genocide. There's no other term for it that's going on in South Africa. And while I had a cursory knowledge of that, it was obviously something that we needed to look into a little bit more. I'm going to share this with you, and then I'm going to bring our friend Mark up. This is an article from, from 4 years ago, from 2015. I'm not going to go into the whole deal, but basically what's going on is this: more than, as of 2015, more than 70,000 white people have been murdered since since Nelson Mandela and the African National Congress took over. 70,000 whites have been murdered. We don't know how many have been robbed and raped and tortured. This is a horrible thing. I can list you some examples of stuff here, but I'm not going to do that. I'm going to leave that to our friend Mark, and we're going to go ahead and bring him up. Now, Mark, welcome to A Conservative's Perspective. We're certainly happy to have you here with us.
Hey, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
As we had talked, Mark, at the beginning of the show, when we were in the green room, if you would, please, in the 80s, the return, I suppose you could say, of Nelson Mandela was much ballyhooed. It was supposed to be seen as a great thing with the end of apartheid, and we're looking at a new day in South Africa. But that wasn't necessarily the case, was it?
Well, that's an interesting point you bring up. So let me go back and kind of frame this, excuse me, a little
sure.
bit. Okay, so I want and I'm talking to an American audience, and I'm not assuming that our listeners are real up to speed on the situation there or anything. So just background geographically, South Africa is at the southern tip of Africa, and it's about the size, if you take Texas, New Mexico, and Oklahoma, put them together, it's a little bit bigger. And then if you take the population of those three states and put them together and then add about 50 or 60%, that's about what you've got. There's about 55 million people in South Africa. They don't have a real good head count, and they've kind of got an open borders problem, so they're not totally sure themselves of the exact population. We're probably familiar with South Africa from gold and diamonds. It's historically been a major producer of those. But it is a critical world producer of a lot of minerals that are just absolutely essential to modern industry. Most of those go to China these days for production. People, of course, are going to ask about things like oil. They're a big producer of coal. Most of that goes to China as well. but petroleum, not so much. They do have some unconventional reserves and some untapped offshore reserves. But that's kind of the situation that we're in now. It's the second largest economy in Africa, second after Nigeria. Nigeria is a big oil producer. A lot of that oil comes over here. And so they passed South African size of the economy. But South Africa has Africa's most developed economy. They've also got highly developed physical infrastructure, financial infrastructure. They've got their own stock exchange. Excellent port facilities. Durban comes to mind on the east coast of the Indian Ocean. So I just want people to kind of have an understanding of what they're talking about, what we're talking about with that. It's billed as the Rainbow Nation, okay, and that's due to the demographics. You're looking at about 8 or 9% that would be white South Africans, people of European descent. Now, the way they categorize it themselves, you've got black South Africans and then coloreds and then Asians. And so the black South Africans are kind of what we would imagine, you know, they're black Africans, but the coloreds are either mixed race or they're people like the Khoi and the San, who are what we in America know as the Bushmen. Those were actually the people that were indigenous to South Africa, and they're not totally black. And then of course they've got a large community of Asians, mostly people from India, but also from China and Vietnam. Okay, so that's kind of the situation there. Now, we recall it was essentially it was a first world country. They had developed nuclear power. They had nuclear weapons. They were a very critical ally of the West throughout the Cold War. And, of course, not just South Africa, but you take a look at all of Southern Africa. You take a look at the mineral wealth and stuff like that in neighboring Zambia and Zimbabwe. There was a lot at stake there in the Cold War. In the Stalin era, Stalin was very focused on Europe. But after he passed away a couple of years later, Khrushchev came to power, and Khrushchev decided to take the Cold War to the Third World. Now, the African National Congress had come together as a peaceful group, and they were looking to address racial equality in South Africa, and they were doing it peacefully. And in the late 50s, Nelson Mandela achieved prominence in the African National Congress, and he took them in the direction of siding with the communists at about the same time that Khrushchev was sending his KGB guys to infiltrate and to destabilize the southern part of Africa and attack the West on that front. And so consequently, Mandela essentially took them in that direction. They also got away from the peace aspect of it and decided to do basically to go to war for it. What is interesting, the history is maybe not so well known. There was an incident known as the Sharpsville Massacre back, I think it was 1960, and everybody kind of sees that and sees the ANC, they had a military wing that Nelson Mandela established called the MK, which means Spear of the Nation, all right, basically a terrorist organization. And the MK was seen as having been established to in response to the Sharpsville Massacre. Personally, I've got some questions about that because there are some details in the Sharpsville Massacre that aren't widely known. There had been an incident immediately previous to the Sharpsville Massacre where policemen had basically been brutalized. They'd been hacked to pieces and gutted. And so when a bunch of peaceful protesters showed up at Sharpsville, the police were a little apprehensive, but everything was going smoothly. Suddenly, some people appeared in the crowd, kind of agitating the crowd and getting them stirred up. And about the same time, they were rounding up more people and increasing the size of the crowd. And facing this, the police wound up firing into the crowd, and a bunch of people died. That's why it was known as the Sharpsville Massacre. But from what I can tell, it looks like it was provoked. Okay. Regardless of that, in response to the Sharpsville Massacre, the MK announced its presence with a series of bombings. And now Nelson Mandela is a hero to some. He's not really a hero of mine, but neither is he exactly totally a villain. What I think he did is I think he made a deal with the devil in taking the ANC towards the communists. Because as he started this, and by the way, very quickly after the MK got started and began their terrorist campaign, Nelson Mandela was imprisoned. He was not a political prisoner. He was imprisoned for terrorist activities. But he was careful that they were trying to do some sabotage. They were trying to avoid the things that would really break down society. He was trying to steer it in the direction of actions which, after the war was over, people could kind of forgive it and forget it. And he steered in the direction of sabotage. While he was in prison, the ANC, the MK were sent into exile from South Africa, and so they could not be in South African territory. And while the ANC was in exile, the ANC turned to organized crime, mainly in the 1980s is when this happened. Now, about that time, if you'll recall, you go back to the 60s and 70s, all the terrorist organizations in the world were basically getting funded by the KGB, unless they were getting funded through Beijing. Well, in the 1980s, Reagan was in office. Our economy was booming. We were building up our military, and the Soviet Union was tied up in Afghanistan. So they no longer had the resources to compete with us and fund all of these wars of national liberation. So funding dried up. Terrorist organizations around the world started siding with drug traffickers. You take a look at that down in Colombia. All right, the cartels in Medellin and Cali started to get with the communist guerrillas that were fighting against the government. The communist guerrillas had troops and they needed money, and the drug traffickers had money and they needed troops, and they both had the same enemy. And so this was kind of a worldwide phenomenon in the 1980s, and the ANC definitely went in that direction of organized crime activity. And at some point, very often happens, ideology becomes less important and actual criminal profits become more important. Yasser Arafat of the PLO was an example of this. But so at any rate, the farm attacks began in Rhodesia. It was then known as Rhodesia, Zimbabwe. They started to try to drive the white farmers off the land there. And the funny thing is that they really didn't start in force in South Africa until after Nelson Mandela had been let out of prison and after they had already negotiated an enfranchised election where all people in South Africa would get to vote regardless of race, and an election that they knew would bring the ANC to power. And that was when the farm attacks started. Now, Nelson Mandela, of course, got elected as the first president of South Africa, and immediately he's faced with this crisis of these farm attacks. And President Mandela saw the problem of the farm attacks, that this is going to impact food supply, it's going to impact food security, it's going to cause, you know, the cost to go up. And so he made the farm attacks a priority crime. And he also encouraged South Africans to join something called the commando system. Now, the commando system, it's kind of like a National Guard, kind of like the French gendarmes. It's a militarized, mostly it's like a reserve force, but they do police functions. So like if an invaded army attacked into South Africa, the commandos would be a militia that would resist them. But on a day-to-day basis, they'd more likely be assisting police operations. And the commandos, of course, dealing with a possible, you know, communist insurgent threat from the previous years, these weren't guys armed with 38s and a baton. These were guys armed with, military grade rifles and things of this nature. And so consequently, a lot of the farmers were members of the commando system. And if somebody launched a farm attack, they had a guy with military training and with military equipment who could defend his farm while other guys nearby were on their way to help him out. And Nelson Mandela encouraged people, especially the Boer farmers, to join the commando system as a way of dealing with the farm attacks. So it looks to me like Mandela was on the right side on this one. However, after Mandela got out of office, the ANC-led government deprioritized the farm attacks. They then stopped keeping farm attacks as a separate crime category. They just went ahead and aggregated all of those statistics with all of the other crime statistics, which crime is really bad in South Africa. It's really bad. It's a murder capital. It's a rape capital. And so consequently, it looks – oh, and then they disbanded the commando system. Now, there were recommendations that the commando system be replaced because of its ties to the apartheid era. But those same recommendations said do not replace it until you get something better to take its place. Well, the ANC-led government, they deprioritized the farm attacks, stopped counting them as a separate crime category, and got rid of the commando system, which to me looks like a pattern of conduct that these guys that took over after Mandela were beginning to allow a slow war to get waged on the South African farmers, on the white farmers. Now, I want to make a couple of points here. First of all, crime is really bad. Depending on the statistics you look at, you could argue that whites in South Africa, on average, are a little bit safer, although it's bad for everybody there. All right. However, you can also take a look at maybe the statistics aren't telling the whole story, because what I'm hearing through social media, through emails, through private messages, is people just aren't reporting this stuff to the police. And then there's questions about whether or not the books are getting cooked, you know, by the South African police service. Regardless of how that goes, based on what the official statistics, certain jurisdictions in South Africa are much worse than a war zone, much worse than anything happening in Syria. There's a place called Philippi East. It's over near Cape Town. And they're significantly worse than Syria at the height of the civil war regarding deaths, homicide, you know, violent deaths. However, a spike in the crime nationwide, a spike in the deaths, is the South African Police Service. They are getting killed in the line of duty at an incredible rate. If you take how many cops die in the line of duty and divide that by the population, it's about six or seven times what we're seeing in the United States.
Okay, Mark, let me stop you for just a second. I have a question, and I don't want to lose it. And so if I understand, at once upon a time, the attacks on the farmers, as you said, they were priority crimes, and so I'm sure that they were dealt with aggressively. And now we see that those policies and the resources to deal with those issues have also been done away with. Is this, and I guess what I'm trying to say is, I'm having a hard time trying to figure out whether all this is fundamentally criminal or ideological, or is it a combination of the two in terms of, what's going on with these white farmers?
I'm getting to that.
Oh, okay.
All right. So I'm sorry, and I probably should have warned you. It sounds like I'm kind of getting off here, but I'm not. I'm going around
the
way
weeds,
to make a point here.
We love the weeds. Take us there.
Okay. So the South African police, you know, they've been, in a way, they've been kind of been victimized by ANC policies, the broad based black economic empowerment, and all that other stuff. Yeah. Long story short, a lot of the good, competent police have been passed over, and they brought in people that maybe aren't so good, aren't so competent, not so motivated. And there's patronage, you know, patron style politics,
right,
and corruption. And so they're facing this society where it's a rape capital, it's a murder capital, and these people, the police can't even defend themselves. The violent death rate is so high. They're stressed out, PTSD, 70 times the average suicide rate for South Africa among the police services, okay? So the violent deaths of the police are a spike in a country that is it's worse than a war zone. An even bigger spike is the violent deaths of white farmers. It is an even bigger spike. Okay, the white farmers in the rural areas have literally the most dangerous job in the world. And so then the question comes back, well, you know, is this just ordinary crime? Okay, well, we're starting to see some of the ordinary crime, but there was a guy named Christopher Gumbi, last name G-U-M-B-I, first name Christopher. Now, he doesn't spell it the way we'd expect. It's C-R-I-S-T-O-P-H-E-R. Okay, it's not the C-H-R, it's C-R-I. And he did his master's thesis a couple of years ago on the farm attacks. And he went out, he interviewed these people, he talked to them. And very consistently what he came up with is that a lot of these farm attacks are perpetrated by highly trained, very well-equipped units. I mean, this isn't just a military unit, because you could pick a military unit from a third world country, they wouldn't necessarily be able to do this. All right.
Right.
These guys are actually they're getting past. And by the way, over the course of decades, the farmers have developed as intricate security systems as they can. They've got dogs. They've got electric fences. They've got cameras. They're armed. Obviously, they got alarms and bars on their windows and things of this nature. All right. So these guys are collecting intelligence on these targets, and then they come in a group. They've been known to have cell phone jammers. There was just another picture floating around on social media about a fairly recent attack where these guys were busted with a cell phone jammer in their car. And I saw one earlier where these guys were carrying it on their back. Okay, they get in. They will overcome the defenses, get past the defenses, and then they are not in a hurry. There's gratuitous violence and torture of the farmers. All right, I don't know. I'm kind of want to spare your listeners the details, but on the other hand,
well,
maybe they need to hear
some of it. I've read some of it, and it's Mr. and Mrs. America. I'm gonna tell you right now, it is horrifying. Take the most sickening violence that you can imagine, the most creative ways of making people suffer, and you'll come close. It's terrible.
Yeah, and you'll come close. Yeah, that's exactly it. And so, you know, then they'll stay there for hours. They're not in any hurry to leave. And one of the things that Christopher Gumbi's research showed is that they are in no hurry to leave. They do not think that the police are on their way. They're just not worried about it. They've got good intelligence support. They know if there's farmers on their way to help out this, or if an alarm has been tripped, and they know the police aren't coming. And so then they stay there. They torture these people for hours. They rape them. They'll kill a lot of people in very brutal, very imaginative ways of torturing these people. And then they leave. They've been known to police up their shell casings and hustle off to an exfiltration point and then leave in a car. So we're looking at training. We're looking at equipment. This is not your usual street band of criminals. and what they get out of it. They'll maybe carry off a handgun, maybe carry off a cell phone, and maybe carry off the equivalent of 40 or 50 U.S. dollars. And you cannot take a group of people that well-trained, that equipped, and have them be sitting there basically all night someplace for the equivalent of a handgun, a cell phone, and $40 or $50. It's just not economical. If you've got a group like that, you're gonna go hit a bank, or one of the things they're having problems with is cash in transit, hitting armored cars and stuff like that. But it's not economical to go and hit a farm like that. And so I definitely get the idea that there's some kind of a de facto government-backed militia doing this. I've also considered maybe it's some type of organized crime. And, of course, the government there is so corrupt. To say it's government-backed and to say it's organized crime, those two things are not mutually exclusive. Okay, it could be both. Now, what we've seen, you've got a high crime rate. You do have people that just they launch into the attacks on the farms, especially recently, and then especially since the election. We're seeing a lot of this where you'll have four or five guys come on with a handgun and a machete and some machetes. But that's not the kind of stuff – I mean, that's bad, but that's not the kind of stuff that we have been focused on, and that's not the kind of stuff that has necessarily been going on for a quarter century. For a quarter century, there has been, in my opinion, a very obvious, very determined effort to drive the white farmers off the land by terrorizing them, by committing attacks so terrible, so brutal, that the ones that hear about it leave. And three-quarters of those farmers have left their farming in the past quarter of a century. So it's an effective campaign. It is de facto ethnic cleansing of these rural areas of the white Boer farmers. And again, like I say, I'm not a big fan of Nelson Mandela, but from what I could tell, President Mandela was on the right side of this. You know, he maybe made some mistakes in his life, but was trying to do the right thing for all South Africans and for the Boer farmers. But with him gone, it's bad. Whatever bad guys there are in the ANC, those guys have been in charge now for a couple of decades almost. And there's no relief for the farmers. President Ramaphosa gets on to TV, and he says there's no white farmers getting killed in South Africa, and there's no farm attacks, and stop talking bad about our country. It makes us look bad. He's denying all of this. And so as people are listening to this, I hope they're going to go check some of this information for themselves. All right, you're going to find white people in South Africa that have it reasonably good. The crime is bad, but they themselves have it reasonably good. Perhaps they're a little bit safer. They're going to deny that this is happening. And, all right, that's fine. They're not seeing it. And then you're going to have other people saying, well, it's ordinary crime. Well, yeah, there is a lot of terrible crime, and a lot of it is really brutal. But there are farm attacks, and there's scholarly research to support this, that it's a separate phenomenon. And by the way, some of my contacts are South African Police Service. They cannot talk publicly. They've got to be careful right. What they say privately. We're not friends on Facebook or anything like that. And they have to be careful because their phones are monitored. But they will confirm that the farm attacks are happening and that the police have it really bad. And then beyond that, they just kind of don't want to really talk too much about it because they don't want to get in trouble.
Well, obviously, whoever it is, I mean, based on what we've discussed tonight and based on what I've read over the last couple of days since you and I have talked about this, it is clear, regardless of the overall crime rate, which is very high, some organization, there's no question that they're conducting some kind of a pogrom against these people. Whoever it is, what would be the motivation in driving the whites out?
Very, very interesting question, and I've thought about this. I've looked at it from a lot of different perspectives. I've considered the drug cartels, which, by the way, South Africa is now a major transshipment point for Afghan heroin. The heroin can't go to Europe via the Balkans so easily anymore because there's so much interdiction efforts. Putin was very upset about how much of it was flowing up into Russia, and, well, he should be. That's one thing I agree with him on. So increasingly, they've taken it down to the coast of Pakistan or Iran and then across the Indian Ocean into Africa, Somalia, Kenya, Tanzania. And as the interdiction efforts get stronger in an area, they just come farther south. Well, South Africa is a major transshipment point now because, first of all, you've got good commercial ties with the whole world. They take it and load it into containerized cargo in Durban or someplace, and then they ship it off to Antwerp, Rotterdam, Hamburg, Gdansk. Some of that crap is showing up down the highway here in Charleston. All right. And if you take a look at, you know, the epidemic of heroin. Most of our stuff in the United States comes up from Mexico, but there's a lot of it that comes in from Afghanistan. There's a growing amount of it that's hitting the East Coast. And, I mean, South Carolina and Charleston are leaders in this. And I just can't help but wonder how much of that is coming in the containerized cargo from Durban. But at any rate, that's another story. So who's behind these farm attacks? What would be the motive? Well, President Ramaphosa is a very rich man. He keeps talking about how the whites need to give up their wealth to help the poor blacks. But meanwhile, Ramaphosa he's worth, what, about $500 million. And the ANC, these guys are, you know, they're looting the country. They're looting the country so bad that it is an example of what we refer to as state capture, where the government is essentially taken over and bent to serve private interests, whether legal or illegal, all right? But the point is they're making profit for the people that are running the government. And right. It's so bad that South Africa has a state capture commission looking into all of this. It was interesting because they used to have an elite in law enforcement investigative unit called the Scorpions, kind of like our FBI. It was a task force that went after corruption and financial crimes. And when they started digging into the ANC, they got disbanded. So then they got replaced with the Hawks, which now the Hawks actually work under the South African Police Service. You know, those guys are in control. And they're still getting some good busts. But I can't help to wonder to what extent is this politicized that they're saying, yeah, you can investigate this guy, but you can't investigate that guy. And we see some of that over here, where they keep right. investigating Trump and never Hillary. But that's a whole other topic. But, yeah, so at any rate, so what would be up? Well, here's the bottom line, all right? Those farmers with the cultural background that they have and with their background, a lot of these guys – you know, served in the South African Defense Forces back during the Bush War. But by the way, they were fighting the communists. It was very obvious, very clear. When they were fighting in Angola, right. It was Cuban troops and Cuban, well, Soviet equipment. There were Soviet East German advisors. After the Vietnam War ended, there were Vietnamese advisors who had combat experience fighting against the Americans, against us. There were North Korean advisors helping the communist forces there. And meanwhile, the apartheid government was under international sanction because of apartheid. And despite that, they were actually holding their own and doing pretty well. And so a lot of these guys have some pretty good military experience. Now, remember that also this was the generation that voted to end apartheid. It wasn't the generation that started it. It was the generation that voted to end it. Okay. And these guys, they would be a core of resistance as things get worse. And so I think what they're trying to do is drive these people out so that the corrupt elements of the ANC, and keep in mind, there's good people in the ANC, and I certainly don't mean to, you know, to be trash talking the entire organization. The organization has gone communist and it's corrupt at the top and in a lot of the ranks, but there's a lot of very good people in the rank and file. I might disagree with them politically, but they're not bad people. All right. But the guys that are in power, if they go farther in the direction of corruption, it's probably these white farmers and a lot of these folks would form one key core of resistance against them. And if you get rid of them, then you can do pretty much whatever you want. Now, some of that farmland, I was taking a look at it out in, is it Limpopo province? Some of that farmland, you know, it's in places where there's minerals to be developed. And, of course, the Chinese could come in, they could take that farmland, and they could do it for industrial farming, all right? They're buying up so much of Africa, and they're doing a lot of that there. They could mine it for the minerals. There's a lot of different things they could do, and there would be kickbacks for the guys in charge that have driven out the white farmers or allowed the white farmers to be driven out and then helped facilitate the sale or at least the long-term lease to the Chinese. So what I think is going on, I think somebody's got something like that eyed as an end game, is get rid of these guys that are going to give us problems as we loot the country further and as we sell it out to the communist Chinese. That's kind of what I think is going on.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking, having a great conversation with Mark Williamson on the things that are going on in South Africa and the motivations behind the white genocide that is positively raging. Mark, do you have any links that you might want to tell the audience about, to where they can go to and look at this?
Yeah, I'll tell you. I don't have them right with me. Would it be possible to give them to you and you put them kind of like in the show notes or in the after notes for the show?
Sure, we can post it on the page. That'll be great.
Okay. One thing I wanted to mention. You know, this word genocide is going to set people off. Okay. And so I want to kind of take the bull by the horns and address that. If people are thinking about what happened in Rwanda and Burundi, where you got people with machetes, just mass slaughter in the streets. Well, you know, on the trails and in the villages, that's not what's going on. All right. White people are not being targeted in that kind of a manner. And so we don't see that kind of a genocide. We see crime happening, but it's not really specifically targeting the whites in that respect. And it's certainly not something like we're familiar with that the Nazis have done. But it is very clearly, when you take a look at the UN definitions of genocide, it does not have to be an entire group of people. It can be a subgroup. And in that respect, the poor farmers definitely are a subgroup of the total white population. And by the way, that word B-O-E-R, and I know I'm mispronouncing it, but if anybody speaks a little bit of German, they know Bauer, all right, is a farmer. It's kind of similar. That word means farmer. When the Europeans arrived in, was it 1652 in the Cape Town area, and then, you know, they established the only people that were there were the Bushmen, the Khoi and the San, and they were nomads. And so there weren't major problems. Ultimately, you know, big power politics being what they are, ultimately the British came in and took over. And so there were two groups of the white folks. There were the ones that stayed under the British rule, and there were the ones that didn't want any part of it and left. All right. Those people are the Boer. All right.
Right.
They left to the northwest, more west than north, largely into areas that had not been inhabited. But there were also encountering some areas that obviously had been inhabited but weren't when these people were getting there. And what happened is there were Bantu peoples coming down. And by the way, the word Bantu, I guess, is considered kind of an insult in South Africa. I certainly don't mean it that way. All right. But the Zulus, all right, they were coming down into the area at about that same time. And they were waging a war of conquest, and it was a genocidal war of conquest. They were ethnically cleansing the areas, and so people were abandoning their property, fleeing the Zulus, or else they would get wiped out. And so the
right.
Boers, they were leaving, they were encountering this area that was either uninhabited or recently depopulated or whatever. And they were setting up farms in these areas. They would occasionally meet with some of the people, and they would trade cattle for land. All right, so they had a legitimate claim to property. There were some wars between the Boer and the Zulus, and the Boer got the best of the Zulus. There were some treacherous attacks and stuff that the Zulus had made peace, and then they attacked them and slaughtered the Boer guys, and then a war resulted. At any rate, it was a defensive war against a conquest, and in the course of a defensive war, the Boer also seized some land. And when you're defending yourself against an attack and you take land has generally been recognized internationally, not so much today, but that has generally been recognized as legitimately gaining title to that land. And so most of the land that they're talking about, and they don't really have very good statistics on who owns the land. They'll try to tell you that like 70% of the land is owned by the whites, and that's not accurate. The other things that they don't talk about is who owns what kind of land. A lot of these white farmers own land that it's out in the middle of nowhere, and it was never really used other than by nomads until the Boer got there and established irrigation, okay? And their claim to it is actually legitimate under historical – when you look at it historically, they didn't come in and take somebody's land. They came in and occupied land that had been depopulated, or they negotiated and worked a deal for it, or they conquered it in a defensive war. And that's one of the things that they're doing. At any rate, so this topic
of
genocide.
It would seem to me, though, Mark, and what you're talking about here, I understand completely. But on the other side, and yes, I people recoil from that word. And when we think of genocide, we think of it on the larger scale. Hitler, mm-hmm. Stalin, the Chinese,
yes,
the Japanese.
Yep, yep.
But at the
yep.
same time, on the other side of that coin, to me, totally uninitiated to anything beyond what I've looked at over the last couple of days and what I've heard from you tonight, it still smacks of that on a smaller scale. And I think, to me, what's more terrifying about it is because of that specificity. That they're singling.
Yes.
I mean, everybody's getting hurt. Everybody, you know, there's a lot of crime going on, granted, but this particular group of people in particular.
Yes.
Clearly, that's
kind of the whole point. When you look at the UN has an organization, the group that tries to prevent genocide. And when you look at their definitions, all right, the stuff that is being done to the Boer farmers meets those criteria. Absolutely. And there's a guy named Dr. Stanton. I think he was an official back during the Clinton administration. And he has made it his work. He's dealt with genocides, and he's made it his work to try to prevent those. He's got an organization called Genocide Watch. And there's different versions of the website out there. Some of them have 8 stages of genocide. Some of them have 10. I'm most familiar with the one where it shows 10 stages of genocide. And he's consistently got South Africa listed at stage 6. It's the Boer farmers and of course, the non-natives to South Africa, people that have emigrated to South Africa. And he lists the people, basically it's the xenophobic people, and then Marxists, the communists, are the ones that are going to be conducting the genocide. And yeah, it's stage 6 out of 10, and there's spikes and into and elements of the other 4. So for example, stage 10 is denial. Well, we see President Ramaphosa saying, well, this isn't happening, and he's insisting that it's not happening. And we see all of the other stages there as well. Mainstream politicians sing songs like Shoot the Boer, Kill the Boer, and they chant things like One Bullet, One Settler, One Bullet. All right, so they refer to South Africans of European descent, white South Africans, as settlers. That in itself is an element of genocide. They are delegitimizing these people and saying that you know, by calling them a name other than they're not South African citizens or settlers, which means they don't belong here. And that kind of encourages implicitly the violence against them. So it creates an atmosphere where people turn the other way on these farm attacks, or where any group of guys with a pistol and a machete think that they're going to try their luck to go and victimize some of these farmers. And by the way, some of these attacks haven't been quite so successful when they're not as prepared, by the way. But yeah, it's definitely going on. And so just because it's not happening all at once doesn't mean it's not happening. It's more of a slow motion genocide. And our responsibility should be to protect people, to prevent genocide. Now, we didn't act when Rwanda and Burundi were happening. We didn't really do enough quickly enough as all of this was going on in the Balkans. Did we ever do anything when the Khmer Rouge started slaughtering people in Cambodia, Kampuchea? All right.
No.
The idea should be to prevent it from happening, not to send in a bunch of guys in blue berets with pistols afterwards and look at the carnage and say, oh, wow, this is terrible. The idea should be to prevent it from happening. And that idea of prevention, there's a lot of things going on in South Africa that need to be prevented. There's xenophobic violence. Right now, their highway N3 goes from Durban up to Johannesburg. Durban is like their major port. Johannesburg is one of the 3 capitals. By the way, their government power is distributed among 3 different cities. It's not like all of our federal power is in Washington. All right. So Johannesburg is a major metropolitan area inland, one of their 3 capitals. The N3 highway goes from Durban up to Johannesburg. The N3 highway is under siege. These people are attacking the truckers, and they're attacking ordinary motorists. And the idea is that they're angry that the trucking companies are hiring people who are not South Africans and giving them the jobs that these guys want. And so it's xenophobic motivation, but it's threatening all of the people of South Africa. And the same way, this racist, genocidal motivation to go after the farmers, but when those farms are out of business and South Africa is starving, it's going to impact all of the people. All right. And this is something that a lot of people don't get. Zimbabwe basically fell apart because they were doing there what the ANC is doing now in South Africa. And when that happened, Zimbabwe is smaller, they're landlocked. South Africa was there to pick up the slack. But if South Africa goes, there's nobody there going to pick up the slack. They completely enclosed Lesotho, which is landlocked. Eswatini, formerly Swaziland, off to one side, is landlocked. Their other neighbor is Mozambique. Mozambique has their own problems. They've got political unrest. They've got their own indigenous Islamic insurgency up in the northern part of the country, called Al-Shabaab, by the way, no relation to the Al-Shabaab up in Somalia. And then as you go up to Tanzania and Kenya, countries that traditionally have good governance, but they're having problems with the narcotics. People with open ties to drug traffickers are winning elections. And then, of course, Somalia has never really recovered from the basket case that it was back in the 90s. You go inland, Zimbabwe is still a disaster. You have to look to Botswana, which is landlocked in the center of southern Africa, before you find a country that's really doing things right. A good U.S. ally, by the way. Neighboring Namibia on the Atlantic coast is also trying to do things right. These are the only rays of hope we have in the region. If South Africa goes, dominoes are going to tumble all the way up to Somalia, and it's going to take a U.S.-led stabilization force to keep Botswana and Namibia from falling. And we're not talking about fixing the problems in South Africa. We're just talking about keeping those problems from spreading to Botswana and Namibia. It's going to take a U.S. stabilization force.
Earlier today, Michael, as I was looking over some stuff, I came across, and I'm loathe to bring it up, but I'm going to. An article from the Southern Poverty Law Center, and I'm just going to read the headline. Okay, I'm just going to read the headline, and I'm sure you'll be able to make a really solid guess as to which way they're going. And the headline, the title of the article is "The Dangerous Myth of White Genocide in South Africa." And of course, they go through, and there are a number of specious arguments, and they try to minimize the evidence of the overt racism against white people down there, and they do the thing. My question to you, and it's a twofold question. Number one, it is difficult for me to understand because this is a pretty serious story. It's been a pretty serious story for a long, long time, and yet here with the establishment media, we hear nothing about it. And number yep. two. I'm just wondering why, you know, I just want you to speculate a little bit on what the reasons for that may be. And number two, it would appear that the time is coming very close for some kind of direct action with what's going on down there. I mean, there's going to reach a point of critical mass where if the international community or a group of nations or leaders has to say, guys, you haven't been able to do much to fix this. We're going to have to step in. This is ridiculous.
Yep. Yep. Okay. Well, first of all, you know, let me tell you, the ANC, like I said, they're you know, basically they went communist. And by the way, it's African National Congress. It's not really a political party so much as it's a group of people working together. And, you know, the people they work with includes the South African Communist Party, which itself had been outlawed back during the apartheid era. All right. But the African National Congress is – they're reasonably militant and they're pretty left of center. They're communist. All right. The second – and they have – I think they got about 55% of the vote here in this most recent election last month. And then right behind them is the Democratic Alliance. Now, the Democratic Alliance, in my opinion, is left of center and moving farther left. They got a new guy that's trying to take them in the direction of the ANC. And then the third most powerful political party is the Economic Freedom Fighters, led by a guy by the name of Julius Malema. Now, Malema used to head the Youth League of the ANC,
yes.
And he and the Youth League actually had training at South African National Defense Force bases. Malema was getting big for his britches and said a few things, and so they kicked him out of the ANC. And then he formed the EFF, which is now the third most powerful party. So the ruling party is way left of center, kind of militant. Then the second most powerful party is a little bit closer to center, but still on the left side. And then this third most powerful party is way out there on the left, very left wing, very militant. And then there are fringe groups. The BLF, Black First, Land First, but they just abbreviate it to BLF. Led by a guy by the name of Andile, and I'm not going to try to pronounce his last name because I'll goof it up and mispronounce it, and I don't mean to. But, you know, he's even more militant, even farther left wing, even than the EFF. Okay, so So the Southern Poverty Law Center is saying that this isn't happening. Okay, well, birds of a feather. All right, they have an agenda. These guys have an agenda. And the left is very racist. The left is very much anti-freedom, anti-free enterprise. And South Africa is the direction they're taking us. They talk about a rainbow nation and all this socialism. But and so that's this image of a socialist nation, rainbow nation working is what they're trying to protect. They don't want the reality getting out of that, getting out to the world of what's really going on. And by the way, let me make a comment on that. So I'm in touch with a lot of people in South Africa now. And it's like I've got more friends in South Africa than here in the United States now. And I get messages from people all the time. I get emails, on various social media. I get direct messages and a lot of communications. Okay, long story short, most of the people, all the people that I'm in touch with are sick of what's going on. And it's not white folks. I would say probably I've got more black friends in South Africa now than I do white friends, or black or colored. They've got their different racial categories. These people are sick of it. They're tired of it. They're suffering under the ANC, and they see what's going on. They've got nothing. Most of the people in South Africa are good people. They want to get along. They help each other. We're not hearing all the good stories either. There was a story I came across a couple of months ago. A white woman, her car broke down. I think it was a flat tire. And there were some black guys walking by, and they fixed it up and put the spare tire on her car so she could get going without having any problems from any criminals or anything like that. So there's a lot of good stories that we're not hearing about. But there's definitely a minority in charge that they're trying to divide everybody up and rule that way, kind of like the way the Democrats play their identity politics here in the United States. And so you've got the EFF, if you can imagine the way it used to be with the Ku Klux Klan here in the United States, only instead of white people hating on blacks and threatening blacks, you got black folks hating on whites and threatening a white man. It's just exactly roles reversed. Instead of wearing white sheets, they're wearing these red berets. Okay. And then the laws that they're passing, supposedly it's like affirmative action. And this is interesting because back in 1965, the United Nations passed, they had a treaty, and I forget what they called, but it was to end racism and racial discrimination. And they specifically mentioned things like apartheid, and it came into effect in 1966. The ANC-led government actually signed it in 94 and ratified it in 98. They're a member of that treaty, but there's a stipulation in there that racial discrimination is okay if you're making up for past discrimination and past injustices. And that's kind of that's kind of ridiculous in a way, because you can always claim that there's something that you need to make up for. So by putting that stipulation in there, you're basically making the treaty worthless. And the ANC, since they've taken over in the past quarter century, they inherited a first world country with excellent infrastructure, and they have taken it in the wrong direction. The blacks were segregated out back in the apartheid region, living in these townships. So they had a long commute that they had to go to work, but they had jobs they could go to, and the commute was reasonably safe. The ANC's taking that in the wrong direction. They're destroying the economy. There's no jobs for these people. Criminal groups are attacking the commuter trains. Commuter trains will be going along, and they have security guards on the trains, and the security guards and the employees get attacked. Okay, and then the criminal groups are more likely to rip up the infrastructure and sell it as scrap. Getting back to, we were talking about the South African Police Service, they're having to employ private security to protect some of their police stations. Now, there's a discussion whether or not, why they're doing that. They say, so we can have more guys out on the street, not back here doing guard duty, which, okay, that makes sense if it's true. But the South African Police Service is abandoning a lot of the more distant, more isolated, like the rural police stations. They're abandoning them in hours of darkness. It's not a manpower issue. It's not a budget issue. It's, they can't defend these areas at night because the criminality is so bad. The South African police cannot defend themselves reliably. And then on top of that, there's a lot of them are lazy, a lot of them are incompetent, a lot of them corrupt. Imagine the good guys that are in there. They're literally risking their lives. They're getting lumped in with the ones that are corrupt. no wonder their suicide rate is so high. But yeah, the South African police and the good guys in South Africa in general, they can't defend themselves right now. And so here's the other thing. They talk about genocide. If this spikes above stage 6 of 10, don't count on the good people coming together and the police being able to get this under control, because they can't defend themselves as it is right now. If it spikes into genocidal violence or xenophobic violence, nobody's going to be able to stop it. It's just, it's going to happen really fast, and we need to prevent that, not send in the guys with the blue berets after the fact.
Well,
did I answer your question?
Yeah, absolutely. we've been talking with Mark Williamson here on ACP. We're down to the last couple of minutes of the show. Mark, I want to thank you very much. This has been a very enlightening hour that we've spent with you. And given your expertise on this, we're going to want you to come back as
okay.
events unfold.
Thank you. Yes.
The thing that I see with this now is it has been a big story for too long for it to remain under wraps. And the mainstream, the establishment media types within the last 4 or 5 years have now come to the realization they are no longer the gatekeepers when it comes to information and sources of reliable information. And I think the podcasters of the last 3 and 4 and 5 years that have jumped on that wave are the ones that see that the clearest. We look forward to having you come back, Mark, as soon as we see some significant develops in this. Thank you so very much for being with us on ACP this evening.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Appreciate it tremendously. Well, there you have it, guys. I mean, that's some terrific stuff. Mark Williamson will be back with us. That was a terrific guest. As you know, we are not necessarily a guest-driven or caller-driven show. So when I bring you somebody, it's going to be nothing but the best, and that's what we saw there with our friend Mark. Good to have him with us. We do this twice a week, live, 7 p.m. Eastern Time, on Blog Talk Radio. BlogTalkRadio.com, you go there, and then you hit the Patriot Nation Radio Network, and you can find us again Tuesdays, Thursdays, 7 p.m. Eastern Time. The recorded version of the show is available at Mojo50 Radio, Mojo50.com, Sundays, 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I think we're going to go ahead and knock it off. A lot of great stuff from Mark for us to digest, and we look forward to having him back. We'll be here Thursday, 7 p.m. Eastern Time, taking a look at things as we do through a conservative's perspective. Until then, God bless America. God bless you. We'll see you then.